time when we're doing oral arguments by Zoom. When it's time for you to begin, you'll see a green start card. When you have 5 minutes yet to go, you will see a yellow 5 minute card. And when your time is concluded, you will see a red stop card. I will help you keep track of the red stop card, but I will always let you answer a question that is pending from one of the justices. So you just need to go ahead and answer. But after you're done answering, I will rein you in and pretty much prevent you from taking off on yet another part of an argument. So with those brief comments, are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, very good. Then I will call our second case of the day, Collison versus the City of Milwaukee Board of Review. Attorney Goldschmidt, will you begin, please?
May it please the court. My name is James Goldschmidt with Quarles and Brady. After Mr. Collison petitioned this court pro se, you appointed me to represent him on review. Mr. Collison's appeal is a good reminder that it doesn't always take a law degree to see the law clearly. Mr. Collison's argument is straightforward and simple. If my property is contaminated, the law requires the assessor to account for that impairment of its value in the assessment. If the assessor fails to do that, the assessment is unlawful. And if a city policy directs the assessor to ignore that contamination, then the city has a bigger problem. It's important for the court to note that the city does not dispute the legal premise of Collison's argument. It concedes that the city was obligated to account for the impaired value of Collison's contaminated property. That's the law. The city also concedes the factual premise of Collison's argument. His property is contaminated. So the court's analysis begins and ends with whether the assessor did what we all agree the law requires. And the record clearly shows that the assessor's valuation included no reduction to reflect the impairment caused by the contamination. So the court must reverse. If I were the court considering this case, I think I would have three questions. The first would be, how do we know that the city applied an unlawful policy here? It says it did not. It's true that the city says in briefing that it didn't apply the policy, but all of the facts in the record point in the other direction. Start with the assessor's report. This is record item 5 at the handwritten marker page 17. The quote from the assessment reads, the owner has not provided any report detailing cleanup costs. Lacking a detailed phase 2 environmental study, it remains unclear as to the extent of contamination that exists on the site or any associated cleanup costs. That is the policy at work. Further on in the same report, at marker page 20, as of January 1st, 2016, the City of Milwaukee Assessor Office did not have any verifiable written evidence pertaining to the extent or cleanup costs associated with any perceived contamination of the subject property. It has been suggested that the owner obtain a phase 1 or phase 2 environmental site assessment report detailing the presence of contamination. That is the policy at work. The assessor who prepared this report had been doing his job for the City of Milwaukee for 16 years at the time of this assessment. He applied the policy that was familiar from his office and that has been included in the record. And he reiterated that at the hearing. And perhaps the clearest evidence on this point is the colloquy at page 64 of the record on appeal. This is also marked as page 69 of 101 in the electronic record. And there, in a colloquy with the board, the assessor says,
Counsel, I am referring to your appendix. Can you help me with detail where it is rather than in the record where it is in your appendix?
Yes. It's page 7 of our appendix, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The assessor says, we recognize the site is contaminated. It's just an unknown extent and or cleanup costs associated with the cleanup with the contamination. And the board member, Mr. Evans, says, so if the contamination was factually known, would that affect the assessment, value assessment of the property? The assessor answers, yes. This highlights the distinction that we've emphasized in our brief between conceded contamination on the one hand and knowing with some degree of perfect precision the extent of that contamination or what it would cost to remediate.
Mr. Goldschmidt, can you? Go ahead. Was that Justice Dowd or Justice Bradley?
I think we might both be asking the same thing. Justice Bradley can follow up. If not, if you keep reading the next line of that colloquy there, Attorney Goldschmidt, the question then asked, will you accept only a phase one or phase two, or will you accept somebody giving you a quote as to what it takes? And the answer was, we will accept any written verifiable evidence done by an expert. There's a follow-up about whether if an insurance company did it, would that be acceptable? And they said it could give us the information. So you're telling us that they applied the policy, yet it appears from the transcript that they wanted just some written idea, because how are they supposed to know what it would take to clean up the site without some indication?
So I'll answer that question in two parts, Your Honor. The first part of the answer is the quote that you highlighted still requires expert reporting before the city will reduce the value of the property, even a dime, to account for contamination. That's just the same policy by different words. Expert reporting to establish contamination is costly, it's prohibitive, and in many cases, it will cost the property owner more than the value of the parcel.
So it's your position that the property owner shouldn't have to come forth with any evidence to support the level of contamination that they're indicating?
No, that's the
second part. How would the city come to know to what level it is contaminated?
That's the second part of the answer to your question. What should be good enough, or what is effectively, what is the city supposed to do? Is it supposed to just take Mr. Collison's word for it? First of all, the city has conceded the contamination here, so I want to make sure that's clear. And there is record evidence supporting that. The best record evidence that Mr. Collison provided was referenced in the assessor's report. And the assessor's report is not in the appendix, but it is in the electronic record. And at marker page 17 of that record item 5, there is a section of the assessor's report entitled Environmental Attributes. In that section, the assessor notes that that Mr. Collison provided a copy of a tank system site assessment report from 2012 that included a comprehensive analytical soil sample report detailing contamination. And Mr. Collison testified at the hearing that what that report showed was petroleum and perchloroethylene contamination at the site. So we believe it's for that reason that the city did concede contamination, but the problem arises because the city requires even more detailed information about exactly to what extent the site is contaminated or how much it will cost to remediate before it will reduce that valuation at all. And that's contrary to the law. The law says if the property is contaminated, then the assessor must reflect the impairment in the valuation, period. And to illustrate the distinction, it's important to understand that even if you don't know how much it costs to clean up a site or exactly how contaminated it is, that very uncertainty has a negative effect on the value of the property. Uncertainty itself can be valued, and it's always going to be a negative value, which is why the statute says impairment. If you look to the statute and you look to the immediately preceding subsection, subsection 1G, that subsection doesn't say impairment. It says effect. The assessor shall consider the effect on the value of the property. An effect might be positive, it might be negative, it might be neutral. But the section we care about, subsection 1M, says the assessor shall consider the impairment of the value. Impairment is only negative.
Counsel, with the amount being unknown and the property owner not providing information, are you advocating for just like some sort of, you know, spitball guess that gets thrown in there? I mean, instead of valuing it at $31,800, if the assessor would have said, you know what, I know there's some contamination, and I have no idea how much it's going to cost to clean up. We don't have information. We told him to provide it. He didn't. So we'll do $31,750. So, you know, does that solve the problem for you? Is that what you're arguing for? Are you saying that's what the statute requires, that there be some downward push merely because of the existence, even if the property owner provides no information about the extent or amount of remediation costs?
So the first part of the answer to that question is, at a minimum, the law requires some reduction. Here there was no reduction, so we know the valuation was unlawful. That's all you need to know to reverse. But I understand the desire to give some direction to the city in terms of what it can do to comply with the law. And so setting aside the fact that it's the assessor's job to come up with a lawful methodology in the first instance, the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual does provide some guidance as to how to go about valuing uncertainty in cases like this one. So we would suggest that the city start by following the guidance in that manual. But I would also say the easiest and most straightforward way to address this problem of uncertainty is to do exactly what the city does with regard to its own decision not to acquire these parcels that are listed on its do not acquire list. Mr. Collison's parcel is listed on that list. What does that list represent in terms of market value? It represents a judgment by the city that whatever value those parcels may have is outweighed by any uncertainty around the extent of contamination on those parcels and what it would cost to clean them up. The city was able to make that judgment without any of the detailed reporting it's requiring from Mr. Collison. And it has determined that in each of those cases, those parcels have negative market value. Otherwise, they wouldn't be listed on the city's do not acquire list. So my suggestion would be, let's take the city at its word and apply its own market decisions for tax purposes, including in this case.
Counsel, we have a statute, of course, that we're dealing with. And the statute starts out in 70.32 that real property shall be valued by the assessor in the manner specified by the Wisconsin YPAM, or rather WPAM, the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual. And that manual, well, let's stay with the statute. The statute sets forth a hierarchy of what's been referred to, three-tier hierarchy. Do you agree or do you, let me phrase it differently, do you contest the assessor's testimony that there was no arm's length recent transaction of the subject property on which to base an assessment?
We do not contest that. The property was last sold in 1979.
Do you contest the second prong of the hierarchy regarding arm's length comparable?
No, we don't. And the absence of any such sales suggests that the property may lack significant saleability in the market.
And the third prong then allows you to go to other methods. Do you contest that income valuation is a recognized method of evaluation?
Your Honor.
Okay, you don't contest that. Excuse me. As I indicated, the threshold statement of 7.32 makes reference to the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual. And it goes through different examples of how to assess property. And then, and I'm referring to your appendix on page 51, severe contamination. Let me speak really slowly so you can have time to find it.
I'm there, Your Honor.
Okay, good. And under severe contamination, in the second sentence, it states, however, there may be some situations where the extent of contamination is unknown, and thus the effect on the value is difficult to measure. While it is not possible to develop specific procedures for dealing with the uncertainty, the guidelines in this section provide a framework that you can use. You agree, however, as I just understood it, that an income approach is a recognized approach for evaluation.
We do, yes.
I want to move to what the Court of Appeals found troubling here, and I think part of that was put forth in paragraph 6 of their decision, if I recall correctly. I don't know. I was dreaming about this case last night, so I have to be careful between fact and fantasy. I also have to be careful that my life is probably, I mean, what am I doing dreaming about cases? I don't know. But paragraph 6 indicates, if I can find it, really, I think that you didn't present evidence. It starts with saying there's a presumption that the valuation is correct. Paragraph 6 goes on to state that you have not shown why Collison's unsubstantiated claim that the property has a market value of zero is more accurate than the assessor. You provided no evidence about the extent of the contamination and cost to clean up, and therefore it's not overcome the presumption. Isn't that the very thing that the manual is talking about when it's difficult, there's no arm's length for either the subject property or comparable properties, that you can come up to the best of your ability? Here, it seems to me that it was recognized, you know, a parking lot is not exactly under normal circumstances in what the Board of Review referred to as an up-and-coming area, or actually an area that's come, I guess. It just seems to me that that may not in other situations be the highest and best use, but because of contamination, it is the best use here. Isn't that what's going on in the testimony and the Board of Review discussion? Can you respond to that?
Yes, I'll try to respond to that in a couple of parts. First, We acknowledge the presumption that the valuation is correct, but that presumption does not extend to whether the valuation was lawful. The valuation still must follow the law, and our contention is that it didn't do so here because it didn't reduce the valuation by even a penny to account for conceded contamination. We also, as I said earlier, concede that the income approach is an appropriate way to value the property in the absence of comparable sales. But the income that the assessor derived here was derived without regard to whether the property was contaminated. It was the income that a parking lot in that part of town could hypothetically command with no reduction to reflect the fact that the contamination was on the parcel. And the amicus made this point better than we did in their brief when they said, a contaminated parking lot is worth less than one that isn't. And the valuation didn't account for that at all as the law required. To the extent that the question touched on Mr. Collison's burden to come forward with evidence, he came forward with enough evidence to establish that the parcel was contaminated. And that's where the law kicks in. The law says, if the parcel is contaminated, then the value is impaired. And there was no reflection of that impairment in the valuation. The last part of my answer goes to Your Honor's point that the selection of a parking lot as the highest and best use somehow incorporated the contamination that way. I would respectfully disagree with that because there's nothing on the parcel other than a condemned building and an asphalt parking lot. So the fact that the parking lot may be the highest and best use was never tied by the assessor to contamination, but rather to the characteristics of the property and its improvements, which are lacking.
Counsel, the manual incorporates the when necessary, the IAAO standards here, and that's pointed out in the amicus. And there's some information about this stuff that seems directly on point here too. In 4.1 of those standards, it talks about unencumbered value versus value and use of property. And it says there's a tendency to discount the value based on costs related to remediating or isolating environmental contamination. Fully deducting the costs may overstate the decline in value because the value in use concept would then be ignored. Value in use suggests that a property which is still in use or which can be used in the near future has a value to the owner. This would be true even if the cost to cure environmental problems exceed the nominal unencumbered value. In other words, you can understand that maybe there's some deduction, but that the value in use is going to be the best situation, particularly when it's unknown. And it also says in there, 5.1 says the property owner must provide clear documentation of the nature and extent of environmental contamination. Accurate and detailed maps must be included as part of this documentation. Without information, property must be valued as uncontaminated. And it kind of goes on along those lines. So it seems that the manual itself incorporating these standards would suggest in a situation where there's no clear evidence here that would be at least permissibly within the discretion here to consider the existence of contamination, but nonetheless use the value in use income approach as a permissible marker of value, particularly when you don't have evidence of the extent of remediation costs.
That may all be true, but we still have the problem that the valuation here stopped after determining the value in use without reducing that value at all to account for contamination. It valued the parcel just as if it were uncontaminated. That can't be consistent with the law. The law says as soon as it's contaminated, the value is impaired. The assessor made no indication of any reduction of that impairment. If the assessor had said, we think the parcel could generate capitalized income of $30-some thousand, and we mark it down $10,000, We could have an argument about whether that was enough or whether whether Mr. Collison should have provided more evidence to get it down further and have all of those conversations. But where the assessor didn't reduce the value one penny, that's the reason that the assessment was unlawful.
So Attorney Goldschmidt, you're reading the language from sub 1M, consider the impairment of property because of environmental pollution to mean reduce the value. So could they, is there a way they could consider it without reducing the value?
It doesn't, but it doesn't say consider the contamination. It says consider the impairment. It assumes there is an impairment.
But it's the verb is consider. So, I mean, I think that's really the issue here, at least for me, is what does that mean?
Well, it can't mean that the assessor just sits in his armchair and thinks about the fact that the parcel is contaminated. For the statute to have any effect, considering the impairment must mean reflecting it in the valuation. That's what an impairment is.
Can an impairment ever have a positive effect on value by its own definition?
No, an impairment cannot. And that is why I highlighted the different language in the immediate preceding section, effect. The assessor could consider the effect and conclude that it's positive or neutral and maybe make no reduction in the assessment. But where the statute commands consideration of the impairment, there must be a downward valuation or the statute has no effect. I see that my time is up.
Yes, thank you. Are you prepared for rebuttal, Attorney Carroll?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Your Honor.
Please do.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jim Carroll. I am an assistant city attorney with the city of Milwaukee. And I'd like to start by noting that the statute applicable here with Board of Review proceedings imposes a presumption of correctness on an assessor's valuation regarding a property. The statute states in at least a couple different places, and I'm referring to 70.47 in 8 sub i, that the board, quote, shall presume that the assessor's valuation is correct, end quote, and that, quote, presumption may be rebutted by a sufficient showing by the objector that the valuation is incorrect.
Counsel, do you agree that the word impairment in the statute we are considering requires a reduction in what would otherwise be the market value of the property?
I agree, Your Honor, that an impairment connotes a reduction. I disagree respectfully with Mr. Collison, or more accurately, my client disagrees with Mr. Collison, that the impairment to this property's value was not considered by the assessor.
How did the assessor consider it? How did the assessor consider the impairment?
The assessor considered the impairment, Your Honor, in the way that the assessor applied the income approach in this case. The assessor valued the property by considering the property's use only as a parking lot. And I think this is something that was recognized both in the Court of Appeals and in the Circuit Court decisions, which I understand don't bind this court. The assessor did not consider income from more lucrative uses that might have been made of the property had it not been contaminated to some extent.
And Counsel, but wasn't the building that was on there subject to a raise order? Could hardly say he could rent the building, right?
You're correct, Your Honor. The building was subject to a raise order.
So the only value that was placed on the property by the assessor was the value of the portion of the property covered by asphalt, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So I don't have a problem with his using the income approach. I don't think there was any other way he could have valued it and followed the menu. My problem is I don't see how he reduced it for the impairment of contamination. And unless you don't agree, it's contaminated. I thought that was agreed on both sides.
Well, Your Honor, if I might speak to that. Sure. Yes, I think both sides agree that the property, well, I don't think both sides agree that the property is contaminated. The big problem, and I think in some ways the crux of the dispute here, is the question of to what extent. And I think that Mr. Collison would rather that the court not be too concerned about the what he might consider detail. But I think that is the critical point here. And the way that the Board of Review sees this is that Mr. Collison is effectively trying to shift the burden that falls on him onto the assessor to provide those specifics.
I would agree that he's got to show it's contaminated, which is why I wanted to be sure you agreed the property is contaminated. You have the information that's been pointed out that was, so the city knows they've gotten that report when the tanks were taken out. What I can't see in the record is a reduction of $1 from a standard income approach, where you look at projected income and you capitalize it. I don't see how there's $1 reduction from how that's applied all the time when you have to use an income approach on a property when you don't have comparable sales. Where is it reduced? I just don't see it.
Well, I see your point, Your Honor, but I would respectfully disagree that it was not considered and that the impairment was not factored into the income approach.
But point it out to me, because I'd like to learn. I mean, I'd like to know, where was the value of the property reduced because of the contamination by $1, $5?
Your Honor, I cannot provide a dollar amount to respond to your question, and so I won't take up your time otherwise. But again, I think that the important point here, and I think this is consistent with the manual and with the statute, is that, and I believe Justice Bradley referred earlier to the provision related to severe contamination. If it was not Justice Bradley, my apologies. But the manual.
The odds are 2 out of 7, so you're okay.
That's right. You have a good chance.
That's a fair point, and I apologize. Yes.
When we're talking about the income approach and the uncertainty, at the very least, that's associated with this property, are we to consider in any way that the city has this parcel on its do not acquire list? So the city has its own consideration of some sort that impacted at least the city's decision that this property is, I don't know if it's that the uncertainty outweighs any value it might have, or I just don't know. I find the argument, take the city at its word, as somewhat persuasive. So when the city won't even acquire this property, but yet it doesn't reduce it by even 50 cents or a dollar, what do we do with that?
I understand the question, Your Honor. Thank you. I think that the presence of the property on that do not acquire list, and obviously the do not acquire list is generated by a different part of the city that is not, frankly, my client here today. I merely represent the Board of Review. But I think that that does reflect, as you alluded to, Your Honor, uncertainty rather than the fact that the property has no value or cannot be sold, rather that until the property owner, on whom I think the burden rests, is able to substantiate the amount or level of contamination and the accompanying expense of remediating that contamination, that it reflects uncertainty rather than a lack of value.
Uncertainty doesn't generally have positive connotations when it comes to figuring out if you want to acquire a piece of property. Uncertainty usually means something like, well, if I could get this for almost nothing, maybe I'd take the risk. of acquiring this property, but maybe not even then, because your cleanup costs may surpass any deal that you may have received on the property. And you'd have to have other reasons to want to acquire property that carries with it such uncertainty. It strikes me that that should have at least been part of the consideration of the city, since it's the city's own word, shouldn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I understand and I agree that uncertainty may not be a positive connotation, but I don't agree that the presence of this property on that list means that the property is without value or is not marketable.
Right. It's not necessary. I don't think we're debating today whether or not it's without value. It's just, do you agree or disagree that uncertainty has a negative connotation? Uncertainty is an impairment to property value. Can you think of a scenario where uncertainty in this context would mean it has equal or greater value?
I can't think of one, I don't think, Your Honor, where it means that it has greater value, but I think it could be reasonably designated as being neutral. It's unclear. And until there's information about the specific level of impairment, then the property's value is uncertain, and therefore the city is not willing to acquire that property. But I respectfully don't believe that its presence on that list is determinative here.
If the property's value is uncertain, then how did they arrive at the value if it's so uncertain?
Well, again, Your Honor, the placing the property on that list is not the same function at the city as the assessment is. So I'm certainly not conceding that the property has no value. What I'm saying is that the city put the property on that list in a process that, candidly, I'm not familiar with specifically, but put that on that list because there was uncertainty regarding the environmental status of the property. And as I said earlier, I think that's really the one of the key points here is that.
One more try. When it comes to uncertainty requiring environmental status of property, can that ever be a positive?
Would uncertainty be a positive? I would say no, Your Honor.
Okay. Is it most often a negative? More often than not?
I don't know how to answer that question, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I just,
in doing some land deals in private practice, I can't imagine a group of facts under which environmental uncertainty means property has the exact same value.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that the underlying point here that I think both yourself and Justice Rogensack have referred to is whether it was taken into account, whether the impairment was taken into account. And my client's position is that it was in the way that the assessor valued the property, and that furthermore, Mr. Collison did not provide evidence to contradict the assessment to overcome the burden that he had, or excuse me, to meet the burden that he had and overcome the presumption that favors the assessor's valuation.
So when I have, is,
I'm sorry, go ahead, Justice Siegel.
If an impairment is negative, then that must mean without the impairment, this property would have had an increased value, but they considered it, so they kept the value the same. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that the impairment was considered in the method of income valuation that the assessor applied here. And I'm further saying that nothing that Mr. Collison presented contradicted the assessment as far as any specific evidence related to the property's value. Certainly nothing to indicate that the property's value was zero or $100 or $200, which I think at varying points in this process were values stated by Mr. Collison.
Yeah, my concern is not so much what the actual value would be if the contamination were lined up with the value. That's not what bothers me. I agree with Attorney Goldschmidt. If they'd reduce it by $10,000, we could have a discussion about, oh, that wasn't enough. That wasn't enough. Then you might get to the reasonableness of the assessment and compliance with the statute under 1M. But, you know, I just don't see how you say because he used an income approach, and he used the standard approach, he did it correctly, at least everything I've ever seen. I don't see how you can say that took into account 1M. I don't see that he reduced it by a dollar. I mean, point if it is, I'm missing it, and I would really like you to point it out to me because I've looked for it.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think I've answered the question to the best of my ability, and I don't see, again, I can't point you to a dollar figure or a percentage reduction, but the position remains that the means of employing the income method took into account the fact that this the best use of this property was reduced because of its unknown, but nevertheless.
How was the income approach that he used different from a standard income approach when you don't have a comparable sale or a reasonably comparable sale and you move to the third tier evaluation? How was what he did different?
Because Your Honor, he did not take into account income from a higher use of the property. This is a property in a prime location that could have been used for things other than a parking lot.
Like what? Like what?
Well, it could have been redeveloped, I'm sure, for any number of other uses beyond that of merely its value as a piece of, as a flat piece of land, essentially.
Are you saying that the choice to use the income approach was the way that it was considered? Because had it not been, the city would have taken into account perhaps sale of other lots in the area. It's right by the Fiserv Forum. Perhaps it could have been a restaurant or a parking garage or something like that. Is that how it was considered?
I think in part, Your Honor, although I don't know that the record is clear on that point. I think that the assessor, and I, in candor with the court, I think the assessor's testimony shows that by using the income only from this relatively low level use as a parking lot, that he was taking into account the contamination. But again, the concern here is that the level of contamination and the cost of remediating that contamination is unknown, and that the burden for providing information, for providing specifics about that level of contamination and the cost of remediation falls on the taxpayer, not on the city's
assessment. Where does 1M give the taxpayer that burden? Where does 1M give the taxpayer that burden?
Well, I don't think it's stated in 1M, Your Honor, but I do think it's stated in the property assessment manual, for example. If one looks at the property assessment manual, it in particular, and I'm looking, this is on page 48 of the appendix. The last paragraph above where there's a break and it says estimating the value indicates, and I'll pause a second to.
I have it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. The assessor should monitor the activities of government pollution control agencies in the municipality to be aware of any contamination. If a property owner believes the property is contaminated, evidence should be given to the assessor because of the special knowledge required to identify the type and extent of contamination and associated cleanup costs. The assessor should obtain copies of reports by government agencies and environmental engineers before estimating value. However, the point there is that it is on the assessor to obtain reports if they exist, and the obligation to provide information is on the taxpayer. And if any reports or information exist, then certainly the assessor should make efforts to obtain and review those. Here, the only report that is in the record and that Mr. Goldschmidt alluded to is the report that says there is some level of contamination, does not say what that level is or what it would cost, whether $10,000 or $500,000 to remediate that contamination. So I do think, I'm sorry.
No, finish your answer, please.
I was just going to conclude that I do think that the manual puts a burden on the taxpayer to provide some information. That doesn't, of course, absolve the assessor of the obligation to do his or her job, but the taxpayer has that obligation via the manual, and the taxpayer has the burden in front of the Board of Review, which is what we're talking about here. The taxpayer has the burden to provide some evidence to substantiate the valuation that they are claiming contrary to that of the assessor. Thank you.
Counsel, you've indicated that you can't give a dollar and cents reduction for the consideration of contamination. You've indicated that several times. You've also indicated just now that what we're reviewing really is the Board of Review's determination. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And this is cert review, so we're circumscribed in our review of this case by the principles of cert review. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
One of the things that's bothering me is that you seem to indicate in the record, you seem to indicate in your responses that because you can't do a $5 reduction or a $50 reduction or a $5,000 reduction, that it's not reflected in the record. I point you to appendix page 24, the Board of Review. That's what we're looking at. What does the Board of Review consider? Did they consider contamination as reducing the value of this property? That's what you've been asked several times in very different ways. And I look at appendix 24, and what's the Board of Review doing? About midway on the page, it says, the Board of Review discussion indicates, the city is asking for written evidence of contamination, which has never been supplied. We all know that looking on the horizon, as you indicated, Steve, with all of the development that's happening in that area, as he also indicated, that this property could be worth a lot of money once the groundwater and the soil has been remediated. I take that to mean that because there's contamination, the amount of value is depressed. Do you take that to mean the same thing that the Board of Review considered as it was ending its discussion?
Well, I thank you. I do, Your Honor. And I would also note on the following page, which is Appendix 25, obviously, at the very top, concluding the remarks by that particular Board of Review member, she notes that at the end of the day, I don't believe that he has met his burden to overcome the city's presumption.
Yes. Now let me, that's enough, because I want to have one further question. The questions being asked by the court, at least in one instance, seem to reflect that there wasn't a debate as to whether this is worth nothing or something. I mean, is it your understanding of Mr. Collison's position that the property is worth nothing, zero?
Your Honor, that is my understanding. And as I think I alluded to a minute ago, Mr. Collison at varying points during this process, as the justices may be aware, there's an initial form that a taxpayer fills out to indicate that they're objecting and to indicate what they think the value is. And then they may at times, in my experience, state a slightly different value when they appear before the Board of Review. And I think at varying points here, the value has been stated as $100 or $200 by Mr. Collison. But I think the position on appeal has been that it is worth zero. And I would maintain that there isn't a lot of distinction there between a property that's worth $200, practically speaking, and a property that's worth nothing. But I think from a practically speaking, Mr. Collison's position is that this property is contaminated. He does not know how contaminated or how expensive the remediation of that contamination would be, and therefore the property is worthless.
So would the board object to our remanding it back for an assessment by the assessor of the value of the uncertainty as to the amount of contamination and the cost of cleanup?
Your Honor, the board, respectfully, the board would object because I think the board here did its job pursuant to the statutes that apply in considering the evidence before it, in applying the burden, in applying the presumption that favors the assessor. Now, I just want to be clear and understanding a point that Mr. Goldschmidt made, that it is certainly not the board's position that it could disregard the law in making its ruling. It has to apply the law to the facts that come before it. But it reasonably concluded that the assessor had considered the impairment, had followed the statute, and it reasonably applied the presumption that the assessor was correct in light of the fact that Mr. Collison presented no evidence other than anecdotally he provided anecdotal evidence regarding the history of the property and regarding his attempts to market the property, but he did not provide any evidence about the impairment of the property by the contamination.
Well, 1M counsel says the assessor shall consider the impairment of the value of the property because of environmental pollution. It doesn't say anything about the property owner having a burden to come forward with evidence to establish the value of that impairment. And I want to return to the Chief Justice's line of questioning about whether or not the assessor took into account the impairment, because I think by his own testimony, he indicates that he did not. I'm looking at appendix page 13, where the assessor said, the approach I'm using is the income. I don't know what the value would be. I don't know if the contamination is 50,000 or 800,000. Goes on to say the potential to park the vehicles at this point, whether contaminated or not, and there's something inaudible, and that's how the city is assessing the property. So I think that testimony says to me, he's looking at the highest and best use of this property as a parking lot, and whether it's contaminated or not, this is its value. To me, that does not consider the impairment of the value of the property because of environmental pollution. And I think the hypothetical in the amicus brief makes this clear. You have two parcels of property that are identical and they're both valued at, I don't remember what the amount was, then the hypothetical, it doesn't matter, but using the income approach, they're valued exactly the same, but one is contaminated and the other is not. And so it strains, I don't see how anybody could say that these two parcels of property are worth the same, because who would choose the contaminated property over the non-contaminated property?
Your Honor, I guess in response, I would note the circuit, I would read briefly from the circuit court's decision, which is on page 37 of the appendix, understanding, of course, that this decision of the circuit court does not bind this court, but nonetheless, I think it puts it well. toward the bottom under sub C, the board and the assessor did not ignore material evidence. The assessor did not fail to take into consideration the impairment of the property's value due to contamination as required by 7032-1M. By determining that the property's highest and best use was to produce income from existing parking spaces, the assessor recognized the very poor condition of the land and difficulty of future development for a better use, such as a high-end apartment building or similar commercial use. And I would also reiterate that this is a review, as Justice Walsh Bradley noted earlier. This is a review of the board's determination, of the board's consideration of the evidence, and that the board reasonably considered that evidence and reached a conclusion in light of a lack of any evidence from Mr. Collison.
Does the manual speak to uncertainty and how that plays a role?
Your Honor, it does. And I think that at least the portion of which I'm aware and most familiar with is again, the severe contamination provision, which is on page 51 of the appendix. And there, I think parts, if not all of this paragraph may have already been read to the court, so I won't bore the court by reading it all again. But I would just note in that provision, it starts by talking about how the previous guidelines relate to common situations where the extent of contamination and its effect on value are readily identified and measured. And then it notes a couple sentences further down, while it's not possible to develop specific procedures for dealing with this uncertainty, the guidelines provide a framework. I would finally note that the last sentence of that paragraph indicates properties with a great deal of uncertainty should be closely monitored and reviewed each year as more information becomes available to reduce the degree of uncertainty.
It looks like your time has concluded. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Are you ready for a rebuttal, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please begin.
I want to start with the city's core argument that it considered the impairment by selecting the income approach. That's fundamentally wrong. Under Wisconsin law, the only time the assessor is allowed to use the income approach is if there have been no recent sales of this property or comparable properties. That's the state ex rel Geipel case that we cite on page 24 of our brief, 68 Wisconsin 2nd at 733-34. So by the point that the assessor determined he could only use the income approach, it wasn't because of the contamination. It was necessarily because the first two tiers didn't work. The question then becomes, how did that income valuation itself account for the impairment? And it did not. Justice?
Could you respond to the argument that the assessor chose the income approach and chose to value it in its highest and best use as a parking lot, whereas arguably, given its location to the Pfizer Forum and an area that's being rapidly developed, you know, if it hadn't had the contamination, maybe they could have put a high-rise apartment or probably apartment. There's no condos being built in Milwaukee. I don't know why. So let's say I could have put a high-rise apartment building there. So then that was how the assessor took account of the contamination, that he selected a parking lot and not a high-rise development.
Two answers to that, Your Honor. The first answer is the assessor never said that. It's nowhere in the record. This is post hoc rationalization that's happening in legal briefs. Second part of the answer is when you're doing a highest and best use analysis, you can't hypothesize a Bucks training facility on the parcel and then say that's the highest and best use. You have to take account of what improvements are there. And all that's on the parcel is a layer of asphalt. So of course the highest and best use is a parking lot that has nothing to do with whether the parcel is contaminated. And that's the problem. Justice Walsh Bradley pointed to language in the board's deliberations and certain comments by one board member that referenced contamination. That doesn't satisfy the law. The law requires the assessment to reflect the impairment. The board did not hold the assessment to that standard. So the board affirmed an assessment that violated the law. Necessarily, that means the board's decision violated the law as well. I want to close with just a couple of data points on the actual cost around uncertainty here, because I think it can, this discussion can sometimes stray into the hypothetical. Mr. Collison did testify that he had already spent $80,000 or $90,000 just to try to get the type of analysis the city was looking for, and he thought it might cost closer to $100,000 to do that.
Right, but Attorney Goldschmidt, he wasn't able to provide any proof that he spent that, correct? He just his testimony.
It's true that's his testimony, and he didn't document it. He also testified without documenting that he had received an insurance estimate of $800,000 to clean up the property. My point is not to hang our hat on those references, but simply to bring this back to the realm of common sense. There is no world in which a parcel contaminated with petroleum and perchloroethylene solvents can be remediated for anywhere close to $31,800. It's almost a certainty that it would cost much more to remediate this parcel. And at a minimum, the uncertainty itself needs to be reflected in the valuation.
Counsel, I want to follow up on your question and your response to Justice Bradley's question. You made the point that when you're doing a highest and best use analysis, you have to take into account what's there. Let's assume this property had no contamination and all you have is the asphalt parking lot. Are you saying that the only conclusion the assessor could have come up with in terms of highest and best use was the same sort of parking lot rental income thing because that's what's there? There's no income, assuming we're in the income approach category, that there could not have been any consideration of other potential income producing elements on a prime piece of property with a slab of cement on it?
I would say that would still be the most reasonable approach. I'm not going to stake out a position that it's the only permitted approach. The assessor could have perhaps hypothesized other reasonable uses for the parcel. He didn't. And the important point is he didn't tie that decision to anything to do with the contamination anywhere in the record. My last point.
Well, if you'd look at your appendix page 14 in terms of tying it to any place in the record, begins at the bottom of page 13 in the appendix. And I'll pause to give you a moment to.
I'm there.
Okay, good. Where the assessor says, we're recognizing, at the very bottom of 13, we're recognizing that the potential for some contamination exists. However, I don't know the level of contamination, and I can't quantify that without reports from professionals after doing more studying, determine what is needed to clean the site. Further on down, he states, it's in a highly desirable area. Doesn't that indicate consideration of contamination, some inability to quantify it with more information, but a recognition that it's in a highly desirable area, the property is?
What that language signifies to me is that the assessor recognized the contamination and then place the burden on Mr. Collison to precisely define the extent of that contamination and what it would cost to remediate before it would reduce the assessment at all. And that is contrary to what the law requires. The law says once the contamination is established, as it was here, the parcel is impaired and the assessor must reflect that in the valuation. If you agree with the assessor that the cost of remediation is relevant to the value of the parcel, that still doesn't mean it's the only way to quantify the uncertainty associated with contamination. And at a minimum, he had to make some effort to do that. The burden, I would say, under the plain language of the statute, shifts to the assessor to do that at that point. And I would remind the court in that connection that the reason the assessor took this approach is because of the city's policy that told him to do so. And I would urge the court not to stop with this assessment, but to look at the policy itself and recognize that it cannot stand because it directs the assessor to ignore contamination that the law requires him to recognize. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you both for a very interesting case and a very good argument and helpful briefs. So we are now going to adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 1:30. We are adjourned.